It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
The guest we're going to have on today is talking about a subject that is near and dear to my heart. I first fell in love with what I would have called Persian civilization as a teenager by studying ancient history. And the Persians are in one of their, you know, perhaps their greatest period. It depends on how you define greatest, but perhaps the greatest period in their history. But they've had many. And, of course, the longtime antagonist in the ancient world of the Greeks. And so you get caught up in the romance and the fascinating involvement the Persians had in the region. Then you start studying how often they have that involvement, and you begin to understand that this is a traditional regional superpower. And then right when I'm really getting heavily into my interest in Persia, the situation with the modern nation of Iran takes a 180-degree turn. When I was a kid, Iran was a nation friendly to the United States. In fact, one of our best friends. The shift to a fundamentalist, religion-backed revolution where the United States was the great Satan was an unbelievable turn of events, not just for the United States, but for the entire world stage in terms of what it did to things. And many people have been born since without any memory of a friendly Iran at all. John Gusvinian is going to talk to us today, well, basically about anything I ask him about. So the deficiencies in the conversation are yours truly not asking more questions about more things. I remember looking at the clock and thinking, wow, I've kept this historian here a long time. I don't want to keep him all day, but boy, I never even got to X, Y, and Z, so that's my fault. And I do owe John Gusvinian and you all an apology for the way this sounds. You know, we have several methods for doing interviews, remote interviews. They all sound great some of the time and then let you down other times. So we'll try something different next time. So my apologies to everyone involved. Any mistakes are purely my own or, you know, imaginary creatures who shall be unnamed. I'll share the blame, maybe. In any case, without further ado, the fabulously interesting John Gusvinian talking about the American and Iranian relationship and, you know, some history. And if you don't know Iranian history, by the way, or you want to understand better the traditional place of Iran in the region, well, this is the tinny-sounding interview you've been waiting for.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Gusvinian. It's Dan. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello.
Let's start off with perceptions here, because I grew up in an era where, I mean, I was 15 in 1980, and I was politically aware. And so growing up, Iran was a country that the United States was really friendly with. And so unlike a lot of Americans born after that time period who've only seen Iran in sort of an adversarial sort of sense, I remember the country as one of our greatest friends in the world, maybe our greatest friend, arguably our greatest friend in that important region of the world. When you go out there today and you want to talk to people about a book that talks about Iran, what kind of sort of feedback are you getting from the countries that were on the opposite side of things like, you know, the hostage taking in 1980 and all that? Have attitudes sort of changed or evolved? Or I mean, what are you hearing back from feedback, I guess, is what I want to know.
Yes, no, that's very interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right when you say that the 1970s, in many ways, were a sort of heyday of U.S.-Iran relations. You know, the United States, or rather, excuse me, Iran was portrayed very positively in the United States. It was a time when Iran was seen as this kind of glamorous kingdom to the east of everything that was threatening. You know, this was a time when the Americans thought of the Middle East, they thought of, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Arab oil embargo, socialist governments in various Arab states, the Cold War. It was not a very positive impression. But when they looked at Iran, they saw a country that was just slightly to the east of all of that, that it was, you know, had a friendly pro-American king who, you know, had this sort of beautiful, glamorous wife and had this very fancy coronation ceremony in 1971 that was broadcast live by satellite into American television. You know, so it was a very positive impression. And it's very easy to forget that now, because not that many people these days do remember that period anymore. You know, at the same time, though, that, you know, that was a state-to-state relationship that was very positive. But there was a huge current of underground resentment that was building against the Shah, the king of Iran. And, you know, he was so closely associated with the United States in the minds of his people, and he had become extremely unpopular. So, of course, that backlash reflected on the United States as well. But to answer your question about the kind of reception and feedback I'm getting from the book, I mean, I think people are surprised to learn that our history with Iran goes back as far as it does. You know, there's a tendency to look at the last 40 years of antagonism, to focus on kind of where it all went wrong, whose fault it is. And I was trying to do something different with the book, which is to say that, you know, history is not about laying blame or looking for who started it. It's not a courtroom. It's about understanding kind of how we got to where we are. And the overwhelming majority of Iran and America's 200, 300 year history has been one of mutual admiration, mutual fascination, mutual idealization. It's been a very friendly history for a lot of its time.
I would argue that it's actually the timing on the book seems fortuitous to me, because I think that it seems to me ripe for, in the near future, some sort of breakthrough, I would say. And one of the things that's so different, and I'm sure you can speak to this, but I'd like to go back in some sort of linear order at a certain point. But now you've got me talking about Iranian, sometimes they refer to themselves as Persian expatriate communities in the United States, that played a similar role in terms of coming to this country after the revolution, that the Vietnamese, who were our friends in South Vietnam, who fled South Vietnam and became a part of communities that have grown up since then in the United States. I knew quite a bit of Persians who were fleeing the revolution growing up, Iranians. And it was one of those things where I remember thinking, God, in so many ways, they have a lot of similarities with Americans. They're a fun-loving people. They like to dance. They're a mercantile people. I mean, there's all these little stereotypical adjectives you could use to describe the Iranians, which, when you think about it, and you realize, well, they're kind of natural friends in a way. And the period of time that we're in right now seems like 15, 20 years from now, we could look back on as a weird anomaly. Let's talk about that history, though, that you refer to. I mean, in Western eyes, Iran was Persia, right? All the way back to Herodotus and all that. And then, as you point out, the real early history of Iran with Western countries is like the Great Game stuff with Russia and Great Britain. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because by the time the U.S. arrives on the scene, Britain and Russia have been active in the region for some time.
Sure. This is, in fact, what gets Iran and the Iranian government interested in the United States in the first place. The Iran, or, you know, the Persian Empire, or whatever you want to call it historically, of sort of hundreds of years, had reached a point by the early 19th century where it was declining, like other Asian powers of its day, and the Middle Eastern powers, the Ottoman Empire and others. It was much less powerful than it had been, and was bitterly aware of the fact that you know, European powers were surpassing it, both economically, militarily, politically, diplomatically. And it was, Iran, it's important to remember, was one of very, very few countries that has never been colonized formally by a European power. It was a sovereign state, a kingdom that stretched back, you know, millennia, but had become so weak by the early, you know, by sort of 1810s, 1820s, that, you know, its territory had been reduced significantly in wars, a very important war with Russia that trimmed even more of its territory. And, you know, it was being pressured heavily by Russia from the north and by Britain, the British Empire, from the south, from the Persian Gulf, and Britain's positions in India. And, you know, both of those two very, very large, powerful empires were really beginning to interfere significantly within Iranian affairs and really pull the strings in many ways in the background. It was a source of great resentment for the Iranians, and they wanted to have what was called a third force. This was a new a sort of policy that was adopted from around the 1850s, this idea that the country needed to adopt a third kind of friend that they could you know, sort of friendship that they could wave in the eyes of the British and the Russians and say, you know, back off, you know, we don't need you, we have other allies. And the United States seemed like a very obvious choice because the United States in the 1850s, 1860s was a country that Iranians didn't know that much about, but what they knew they really liked. What they knew was that this was a country that had come into existence just less than a century earlier on the back of a revolution against the British Empire. and that it seemed to not be interested in interfering in the affairs of other countries. The only Americans they knew were the Protestant Presbyterian missionaries who had come to Iran and built schools and clinics, but there was no American embassy. There was no, you know, there was no political diplomatic presence on the part of the U.S. government, and that kind of made the U.S. this kind of alluring blank slate that seemed to have a very hands-off and even in some ways anti-imperialist kind of viewpoint. And so they began to cultivate an American friendship. And every single Iranian government from the 1850s to about the 1940s made American friendship a key part of its foreign policy to cultivate a sort of third force against the British and the Russians. The anecdote I love to tell is that the very first disagreement that Iran and the United States ever had was in the 1850s when they were signing their first treaty of friendship. And the core, it took 5 years to negotiate that. Longer than it took to negotiate the nuclear deal in 2015. And you know, you think, why? And it turns out one of their main sticking points was that the Iranians wanted to purchase American warships manned by American sailors flying the Stars and Stripes in the Persian Gulf to send a message to the British. And the Americans said, no, no, we don't want to interfere in your affairs. It's incredible to think that that was the first disagreement. If you know Iranian-American politics today, but, you know, it was the Iranians saying to the U.S., we want you more involved in our business. The U.S. saying, no, no, we don't want to get involved. So that's kind of how far we've come in 170 years.
Now, in this early period of connection between the two countries, how would you describe the governing system of Iran or Persia at this time? Is this an absolute monarchy or what do we have? There's a parliament of sorts. How would you describe the system in modern sort of political science terms?
Yeah, in the 19th century, it was an absolute monarchy, like many governments in the world at the time. But it was a weak monarchy. There was not a strong central state that exercised complete power over all aspects of people's lives throughout the territory that it governed.
A lot of tribal areas and such, right?
It's tribal areas, various entrenched landowning interests, very feudal in many ways, to use a kind of European terminology. So there was, you know, the court, the royal court and the king, you know, the Shah governed largely through alliances and politics and, you know, that sort of thing. But interestingly, you know, you mentioned the parliament. Iran had a constitutional revolution in 1906 and became the first Muslim country with a parliament, a majlis, the first country in Asia to have a parliament, and that was a revolution that was largely instigated by actually conservative interests. Oddly, this is one of those things. So Iran has always had revolutions, not two revolutions in the 20th century in modern times, and both of those have been quirky. They've been sort of unconventional revolutions that don't follow the standard playbook that we're used to. The constitutional revolution of 1906 was led largely by clerics, by Ayatollahs, and by bazaar merchants, you know, traditional traders who felt that the Shah's government was giving way too much to foreign powers, that they needed to be consulted more for various reasons, and also a smaller group of kind of liberalizing intellectuals as well. But those were the forces that led that revolution. And in many ways, those were the same kinds of forces that came together in the Islamic Revolution of 1979. It's paradoxical. They're forces of conservatism in many ways, but they also are forces of radicalism.
There's a theme, though, and it runs through the book and it runs through this Iranian history. And the theme is this public dissatisfaction with the Iranian government's giving away too much to foreign governments, whether it's too much of the oil rights or the tax revenues or the decision-making power or whatever it might be. It's weird to find so many similarities between the public attitudes of, say, 1906 and 1979. But I see, you know, you would see that same theme and even the criticisms against the Shah and whatnot. This is a weird thing to say because every nation has this, but Iran seems to have this sense of national pride that can get a government overturned pretty easily if it's seen to be giving away too much to especially the traditional enemies, the British and the Russians. But as soon as the United States steps in and plays a similar role, then we become just as much of a target for the, for, as you said, the artisans, the bizarre people. Would you say maybe those are almost a kind of a middle class representation, and the clerics and the religious folks? And then you have a third force you mentioned that comes in the 20th century, where you have a sort of a Marxist leftist side too, and the three of them, all of them though, seem to share this antipathy toward the idea that you're giving away too much of the country's sovereignty or resources to other countries.
You're absolutely putting your finger on it correctly, I think. And in fact, this is the core of, to me, you know, the history of U.S.-Iran relations. There is this common thread that runs through modern Iranian history. You're absolutely right. It is a unique country in a lot of ways. Of course, every country is unique, but its history, I guess, the uniqueness of Iran's history is that this is a country that has been at many points in history one of the great powers of history. I mean, the Persian Empire, the first ancient Persian Empire of the Achaemenids, in 6th century BC. Once ruled over almost half of the population of the world. I mean, it was a country that had a very strong sense of itself, and yet also was a declining power, in the 1800s and the 1900s. But also, not only was it a kind of declining post-imperial power, but it was one that was not invaded or colonized formally by other powers, which gave Iranians in many ways a certain... it was a perfect storm, right? It created this country, I think, this modern state that has a lot of pride and sense of itself and its history. Yes, has a little bit of a chip on its shoulder about kind of its faded glory, but also is extremely touchy about what appear to be kind of violations of its sovereignty, its national integrity, being kind of pushed around or told what to do, or have people pulling the strings in the background. Now, all of this plays out at numerous points in its history, but also in numerous points in its history with the United States. This is those forces you mentioned. The first time we really see this in terms of U.S.-Iran relations is in the 1953 coup, when Iran tries to nationalize its oil industry. The British oil company, Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which at the time has a monopoly over the oil production and profits in Iran, precipitates a long-running feud with the Iranian government and eventually convinces the United States to overthrow Iran's very popular prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953. Mossadegh, what we forget about him is that the reason he was so popular is that he put his finger very much on the zeitgeist of Iranian nationalism of the 1950s, the modern rising nationalism, which was not unrelated to the nationalism that you're talking about from the 19th or early 20th century. It was the reason he was popular was because he came along and he said, we need to give more of a voice to the people, but also more of a voice to ourselves as a country. And those two things go hand in hand, the Shah's powers need to be limited. There needs to be more representation through parliament and democracy. But that when you do that, people will also be demanding an end to British or other kinds of foreign interference in the oil industry, and vice versa. That true sovereignty, true national self-determination, and democratic representation are two sides of the same coin. That has been the common thread through so much of 20th century Iranian history.
Well, now you got to 1953 before I was going to get there. That's such a key year. But let's get to a little bit about why something like that might matter to a lot of the other great outside powers, right? So in the Great Game era, as you pointed out, Britain's concerned with the strategic location of a place like Iran, right? This is a bridgeway to their empire in India. For Russia, this is part and parcel of their whole – they've got a lot of provinces in that region. But it's oil that changes things and puts them in a different dimension. I mean, otherwise, somebody said that about the Middle East once. I mean, what is the Middle East without oil? Can you imagine? We wouldn't have been involved like we've been involved all these years. And by the time 53 rolls around, the reason anybody cares to the degree that they do is because of the oil company that you just mentioned, that Britain partners with Iran with. But let's talk about that first. Let's get backwards a little bit and get to the oil, since the oil is so much a part of everything. You know, oil and money might as well just make them interchangeable in this case. The United States is a big oil producing country in the early 20th century. Iran's not even on the map. The Middle East is not even on the map because nobody needs oil in the Middle East yet, because nobody's got a shortage anywhere. Talk to me, though, about this, because isn't Iran one of the early Middle Eastern oil fields?
Iran is the very first major, big, like kind of large-scale oil discovery that takes place in the Middle East. Yeah, in 1907 at Masjid al-Sulaiman in southern Iran. But you're right. It's interesting when that takes place. You know, it's a huge discovery and it's very profitable for William Darcy, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company.
And he got. We should stop here, because one of the things that you said that just blew my mind is he got the rights to drill all of Iran's oil for years and years and years for like 20,000 British pounds or something like that.
That's right. It was an incredible deal. It was one of the best deals I think anyone's ever got. I mean, I think, you know, because at the time, no one knew how much oil there was in Iran and, you know, or how valuable it would be. And Iran's government was extremely cash strapped at the time and gave away this concession, the rights to drill of a huge portion of the country and to take the lion's share of the profits. And, you know, the Shah's government at the time needed the money, had no idea what potentially lay underground. And what's interesting, of course, as you point out correctly, the early 20th century, you know, oil, you know, it's a valuable commodity, but nothing like what it became later. As late as 1910, the United States was exporting oil to Iran, right? The United States was the big oil exporter, the big oil producer of the late 19th, early 20th century. I mean, the oil fields of Pennsylvania and Texas and so on. So it's, when oil is discovered, of course, I think we have to be a little bit careful, because I'm not one of these people that, you know, sort of will claim that, you know, everything's all about oil. You know, I think that, it's there and it's important. And money, of course, as you correctly point out. In the early 20th century, no one really cares that much about oil. Right? It's what starts to change is in the 1920s. After the First World War and after the great powers begin to see for the first time the potential that the internal combustion engine and oil have for powering their navies, their fleets, as well as, of course, motor cars and other things, that it becomes seen as a much more valuable commodity. And there is a bit more of a race or a scramble for Middle Eastern oil among the British, the Russians, Soviet Union, as it becomes, also the United States, which is incredibly actually amateurish and naive when it comes to Middle Eastern oil in the 1920s. I mean, they blow up opportunity after opportunity to get into Iranian oil. In the 1920s, Sinclair and the Standard Oil Companies are both trying to get concessions in Iran. And it's just an absolute, sort of boondoggle. It doesn't go anywhere. The British completely outsmart them, and they continue to maintain their monopoly over Iranian oil until the 1950s.
Well, and if we remember, the difference between the Russians, the Americans, and the British when it comes to oil in this time period is the Russians and the Americans have a generous supply within their own borders, and the British don't.
Exactly.
You point out a wonderful thing, and that's that it's not all about oil and it's not all about money. There are other elements that are very important, and one of the ones you bring up and that we in the West don't pay enough attention to is the religious side of this, and very specifically the fact that the people in Iran are, for the most part, their version of Islam, for the most part, is the Shia version, and they're probably, would you correct me on this if I'm wrong, the most populous Shia state in the world?
That's correct. I mean, Iran is really sort of the nerve center of Shia Islam. And you know, for those who are maybe not particularly versed with these things, I mean, you know, the Shia are and remain a minority. The Sunni are, of course, much more populous.
You mean in Islam as a whole?
Sorry, go on.
You mean in Islam as a whole, not in Iran?
Yes. Yes, correct. I'm sorry. There are far more Sunni Muslims than Shia Muslims in the world. Yes. But Iran is one of the very few countries that is, you know, overwhelmingly majority Shia. Around 90% or so Shia. There are other countries that have Shia majorities or significant pluralities, but nothing quite like in Iran. I think it's significant. I think if anything, actually, weirdly, I would say that in some ways, I think sometimes we overemphasize religion when in the West, when we're talking about Middle Eastern states. I mean, you know, the religious aspects are, of course, important, but they don't define everything. I mean, it's really not until the 1970s that religion becomes a serious force in politics. And we see that, of course, in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. But for most of Iran's modern history, the clergy are very much like sort of small-c conservative. They're quietist, as they're sometimes described. They support the state. They play roughly the same role that the clergy have often played in, you know, kind of European traditional societies before the 20th century. So in some ways, it's not that different from the history that we know. I mean, if you're in Iran in 1900 versus in Russia in 1900, or or Prussia in 1900, or Italy in 1900, you're going to see a very similar kind of state in many ways. I mean, there are differences, of course, but, you know, you're going to see monarchies, you're going to see clergy playing a significant role in rural communities, as well as, you know, at the very nerve center of the state and of the royal court. But in a way that's not radical, in a way that's not revolutionary, in a way that's actually about maintaining the traditional order.
Well, and worth pointing out that the religion in the West was more important in those days, too. So a comparison in 1900 is more apples and apples. So let's ask then the obvious question. Before we get to the pivotal year of 1953, seems to me the Second World War is a pretty important time on the Iranian timeline, because once again, their particular location makes them extra valuable. And the fact that a country like Germany, who one of their main deficiencies in the world is the fact that they don't have access to oil. Talk to us a little about how Iran becomes this focal point in the Second World War when it would seem to be a long way from most of the major battlefronts.
Yeah, it's fascinating, actually. I think that Iran's history in the Second World War is very interesting. And it's also, by the way, the first time that large numbers of Iranians and Americans, ordinary Iranians and Americans, come into contact with each other. But I'll sort of come back to that. I mean, you know, Iran's role in the Second World War is interesting because it's a neutral country. It has been neutral, you know, dating back to the 1820s. It hasn't, you know, it had maintained its neutrality, or it had tried to in the First World War unsuccessfully. It had been invaded. But in the Second World War, it really tries to insist on its neutrality. You know, the feeling is this war doesn't have anything to do with us. Why? You know, it's a European war, and you know, they try to stay out of it as long as they can. But unfortunately, you know, so there is, of course, the oil issue. All of the major belligerents of the Second World War very much want oil to power their armies and navies and fleets and so on. But also the Allies are very concerned because there are large numbers of Germans living in Iran. Iran's government in the 1930s had begun to draw closer to Germany's. It was certainly not, by any stretch of their imagination, a sort of Nazi sympathizer. But there was a feeling, there was a historic lingering resentment against Russia and Britain. And of course, when the Soviet Union and Britain joined forces in the Second World War, it was natural that Iran would be more sympathetic to both Germany and its allies. So, of course, the Allies didn't like that. They tolerated it for a bit, and then they moved in and invaded Iran in 1941 and overthrew the king at the time, Reza Shah, in September of 1941. It took 3 weeks to depose him. They replaced him with his very, very young son, 22-year-old Mohammad Reza Shah, who became the last king of Iran, the last Shah of Iran. Once the Allies invaded and occupied Iran, they agreed that they would leave by when the war ended, but they divided it up into northern and southern sectors, the sort of Soviet sector and the British sector. And the United States played the key role of connecting these two sectors, because Iran had just finished completing a trans-Iranian railway that connected the Persian Gulf in the south up to the Caspian Sea in the north. And that railway had been partly built by Americans, actually, but the U.S., military sent over what was called the Persian Gulf Command at the time, 30,000 American GIs. It was one of the least known operations of the Second World War, but it was actually a very critical one, because after Hitler had opened up the Eastern Front against the Soviet Union, the Moscow was completely cut off from Western supplies, and there were not a lot of good ways to get material into Russia. There was the northern route, which was very cold and very difficult. But one of the best routes was across Iran. So the Allies occupied, they invaded, they then started shipping huge quantities of American Lend-Lease supplies along the Trans-Iranian Railway up to the Soviet Union. And it was American troops that that did that. So, and then they were stationed there for a couple of years. So you had, you know, thousands of Americans for the first time stationed in Iran.
And so then you get the post-war period where we get to the Cold War worries about communism. We get to the oil becoming even more important. We get to the British post-war situation, which is difficult to say the least. I mean, it's trying to find a soft landing from empire. And so talk to me a little bit about the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and the kind of deal that Iran had to put up with. And in other words, I'm trying to put Iran into a situation here where anyone from any country could kind of understand how a deal like that grated against them, how it was almost a deal from pre-colonial sort of expectation eras. And now we were in an era where it just looked like a really bad deal by modern standards. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's exactly right. I mean, the British were absolutely bankrupted by the Second World War. As you say, yes, looking for a soft landing is a good way to put it. I mean, they were trying to adjust this new post-imperial reality, which took some time. But they desperately needed money. And the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company had been and continued to be the source of great profits for the United Kingdom. Of course, after the war, Britain creates this massive welfare state under the Labour government of Clement Attlee, but needs to fund it. And oil from Iran, this is, I mean, one of the things that's often not appreciated in Britain, actually, is just how much of the British welfare state that people kind of cherish and take for granted, things like the National Health Service and so on, was really funded, not entirely, but in very, very large measure by the profits from Iranian oil. Of course, in Iran, this was an increasing source of resentment because it's the 1950s now. People are, it's different. It's not the 1910s. It's not the 1850s. You know, the sort of imperial colonial era seems to be drawing to a close, and people don't appreciate this very large foreign company that has a monopoly over the country's oil, that employs 30,000 people, but treats Iranian manual laborers very differently from British workers who come in and have these beautiful suburban homes with, you know, lawns and, you know, air conditioning and so on, and, you know, houses Iranians in these kind of slums and has kind of separate water fountains and all those kinds of things, you know, in their own country. One of the things I love is that, you know, the British compound in Abadan, you know, had a Persian club, you know, that it was called, where you would go for cocktails and so on, but it was, you know, very conspicuously labeled, you know, not for Persians, you know, British only. And this is the stuff really started to grate on people, on top of which this oil company is taking 80-90% of the profits, and, you know, is not opening up its books to the Iranian government, not sharing the wealth, refusing to adapt to modern times, or, you know, and it really starts to, and you have this now, but also this rising generation, 1950s, of increasingly educated, modern, middle-class Iranians, who see what's going on, read newspapers, you know, hear the stories, and are, you know, very resentful of this. And they coalesce around their hero, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was initially a parliamentarian, a member of the Manchester Parliament, who becomes chair of the Petroleum Committee, and really is an uncompromising figure, a very charismatic figure, an elderly man, an aristocrat from an earlier era, but one who was very sort of liberal and democratizing, and also believes very strongly that the time has come for the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company to leave, to hand over Iran's oil to the Iranian people and to the Iranian government, to nationalize the oil company. And he tries to do that. The British declare this an illegal act. They refuse to have anything to do with it. There's a two-year kind of battle that goes on. They drag it to the Hague and to the United Nations, the World Court, and all these kinds of things. And they impose sanctions and they threaten the war. You know, a lot of the stuff that we see today around the nuclear issue in some ways. But this time it's the British, right? And initially the Truman administration in the U.S. is, if not sympathetic to the Iranian position, they're trying to play the neutral, you know, kind of neutral broker, saying to the British, look, we understand where you're coming from, but times are changing. do a deal with these guys, you know, hand over the oil company, you know, they'll still let you, you know, take some profits, but, you know, symbolically, like, you know, you need to give more than you're giving. And the British are, and in particular the oil company, is very unwilling to adapt. It still is very much trapped in a sort of colonial mindset. And, you know, the controversy continues until you get conservative governments coming to power in both Britain and in the US. Churchill and the conservatives come back to power in 1952, and Eisenhower and the Republicans come take the White House for the first time in 20 years at the beginning of 1953, and they ride to power in a wave of kind of anti-communist rhetoric. And the British see an opportunity. They see that this is a very strongly kind of Cold Warrior, anti-Soviet, anti-communist kind of new administration in the U.S., and they play up that angle. They don't go to the U.S. and say, you know, help us out with our oil company. But they say, listen, Iran is not ready for democracy, for someone like Mossad there. The Russians are going to take advantage. They're going to foment a communist revolution. You know, look, he's already relying on Marxists to remain in power and so on. And they increasingly destabilize the country, and they run, you know, a lot of propaganda and false news stories in the newspapers and things like that. And eventually, peel away some of his allies and convince the U.S., the CIA, that they should help to overthrow the government in a coup, and they do that in August of 1952.
Okay, this is your whole book deals with this in such a way as to really, I mean, that was too quick of a rundown, is what I'd say. This is, I considered 1953 to be the worst example of the concept of blowback that the United States has ever encountered. And one can say that, you know, when I was growing up in the 1970s, we had this blowback by the end. Vietnam was considered a blowback situation. Watergate was a domestic political blowback situation. I mean, we felt like we were being whipsawed by reaping the whirlwind of a bunch of decisions that had been made two, three, four decades previously. And 1953 is a perfect example, because by the time Iranians are taking Americans hostage in 1979, 1980, the advantages, right, the plus side of the blowback maneuver has been paying off for decades. But the bill comes due later, and when it did, most Americans did not. I can say 98% of Americans made no connection between 1979 and 1980, and the fact that the fuse on that explosive had been lit back in 1953. So let's talk a little bit about that. Most Americans still know nothing about Operation Ajax and that whole thing.
Yeah, it's funny you said that. I mean, Jimmy Carter was asked during the American during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He was asked by a reporter about 1953. You know, that the question was phrased exactly, you know, along the lines that you just did, and he said, you know, that's ancient history.
Oh, I would have thought he would have known too. He was a pretty intelligent guy.
Oh, he was, and I'm sure he knew the history. But I mean, you know, he didn't entertain the premise of the question. But of course, for Iranians, it was very much not ancient history. It had been 25 years, and that, you know, that generation that led the revolution in Iran in 1979 was younger, angrier, more radical, and less compromising with the United States than the generation of 1953. The young, idealistic, modern middle class of the early 1950s in Iran was very liberal and Western. And Mossadegh was a very pro-Western figure. He believed in constitutional government and parliamentary. I mean, he was just obsessed with the idea of parliamentary procedure and the importance of parliamentary sovereignty and popular representation. And he had done, you know, he had been educated in Switzerland and France in constitutional law. You know, he inspired that generation of Iranians to believe in you know, in liberal parliamentary constitutional democracy as a way to get your needs met and to hear and to be heard and to you know, liberate your country from foreign powers and so on. But the lesson that Iranians had drawn from that was that, you know, the moment you tried to do that, you know, the world's greatest democracy, the United States, had come in and overthrown the government because it was not seen as aligned with their interests. So 25 years later, it was very difficult for that aging generation of pro-Mossadegh activists of the 1950s to say to young radicals, well, you know, you have to publish newspapers and run petitions and, you know, run for parliament. You know, they weren't having that. They said, we're not doing that again. You guys did that and you know, you got screwed. And they turned more to religion, or they turned more to Marxism. So, and those, you know, forces fused in the Iranian Revolution of 1979. to overthrow the Shah.
So we haven't really explained though what 1953 was. Yes. So in 1953, so Mohammad Mossadegh is the prime minister, right? He's elected the head of the government. He wants to renegotiate the deal with the Anglo-Iranian oil company. The British don't like this. If the way you frame it, which I don't consider to be incorrect, is sort of that the British are able to, in a way, poke Eisenhower in places where he's sensitive, because you quoted him a couple of times in a way that made it sound like, and I generally like Eisenhower's, and he has a kind of an anti-imperial middle America sort of Norman Rockwell side to him that comes out sometimes. And you had a quote or two which sort of represented that in the book. But then I remember thinking to myself, yes, but then the British come back and find those sensitive spots on Eisenhower, the communism stuff and all the other things. Can you explain a little bit this dynamic between the British, who are still trying to piece together little bits of colonial things where they can, a guy like Eisenhower is not real sensitive to that, but both of them in probably, I'd say, 53, we're talking about the depths of the anti-communist Red Scares, the second Red Scare is what we call it in the U.S., era. How were the British able to sort of manipulate Eisenhower into doing something that they wanted, but that Eisenhower could not be counted on to do it for the reasons the British wanted it done?
Yes, and it's important to say, you know, I don't know that it was Eisenhower that they really kind of convinced, you know, it was members of his administration, in particular the Dulles brothers.
Yeah, the Dulles brothers were always up for that, though. I get the feeling they never met a coup they didn't like.
Well, but this was the first one, right?
This is the first one, exactly.
This set the model for all the
other. This is the big CIA's first one, right? We should tell that there was no CIA. There was an OSS in the Second World War. After the Second World War of 47, 48, the creation of the National Security State, which included the CIA. So it's this fledgling group of people that have grown out of the OSS, and this is their first attempt at a covert overthrowing of a government. Did I get that correct?
Yes, and it goes, you know, in their minds very, very successfully, you know, kind of in quotes. It becomes a model. You know, it becomes a model in the next year in 54 in Guatemala and Chile in the 70s. Again and again, it's kind of a so-called dirty tricks operation that by the 70s have become kind of fallen out of favor in many ways. But this, you know, this was a watershed moment for the CIA and for American intelligence operation. The British were able to make their case on a number of levels. They had been, you know, they had been bribing newspaper editors in Tehran to run negative stories about Mossad. You know, they had been bribing politicians to, you know, withdraw their support from him. They had been imposing very severe sanctions on the Iranian economy that had really been making very difficult for Mossadegh to govern. And they'd been working on the Shah as well, the king. You sort of forget about him. He's a young king at this point. You know, Iran is not a true constitutional democracy at this point. It's a sort of hybrid where the Shah still has control over, you know, the defense ministry and the army and so on. And isn't a huge fan of his prime minister, actually. He feels a little bit threatened by him, and they're able to take advantage of that. But the case they make to the Americans, the CIA and the State Department in the new incoming administration, again, is a Cold War case. And, you know, they're able to do that by already having destabilized and weakened the Iranian government so much in all the ways that I just described. So it becomes easy for them to say, look, we have this ready-made kind of plan for like how we can get rid of Mossadegh. You know, he's not, you know, you can't, you know, he's not a communist himself, but I mean, there's a risk that Iran is going to open up to communism because of its instability and its inability to govern and so on and so on. And it's important to remember that, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, had very different visions for how to deal with communism in the third world, as they called it at the time. The Democrats under Truman and later under JFK as well, very much took the attitude that people like Mossadegh were exactly what you wanted. They were social Democrats. They were liberals. They were, you know, they were building welfare states in their countries, but they were very anti-Soviet, because they were. I mean, they were Western. They were, you know, Democrats. They were not communists by any stretch of the imagination. What they were doing, and what the Democrats liked, was that they felt that leaders like that, by building welfare states, by, you know, funding education and literacy and healthcare and all these kinds of things and labor unions, would actually take away the appeal of communism. in impoverished countries, give people less of a reason to turn to communism. The Republicans saw it very differently. They said, no, it's a slippery slope. You know, anything that looks or smells like communism is might as well be a communist. You know, it's in a developing country, people don't have a democratic tradition. They're not ready for democracy. There's too much of a risk of destabilization, and the Soviets will just take advantage and they'll foment a coup and they'll have a communist revolution. Now, both of these were reasonable attitudes in their own way, and they sort of made sense. But as long as Truman had been in power, the British hadn't really felt that they had a friend in the U.S. when it came to Iran. They were very frustrated by the Americans. They felt that the Truman administration just didn't understand what they were dealing with. You know, that they were young, these sort of American naive neophytes, you know, who were idealistic. And, you know, there were a lot of, you know, kind of communications back and forth between the British and American governments. You know, so the British sort of saying, you know, you don't understand. We've been dealing with these devious Persians for decades, you know, for much longer than you have. I mean, you know, you have to take a tough line. You know, and they were frustrated because they weren't getting cooperation from the Truman administration. You know, Truman was trying to take kind of an even-handed approach. But when Eisenhower came in, and it came in, you know, the 52 election was very much fought on the idea that, you know, that there were, you know, pinkos and closet reds in the State Department, and, you know, that the Truman administration didn't really want to win the Korean War because the State Department was...
Oh, this is the McCarthy era blooming, absolutely.
Exactly. And that kind of fire-breathing anti-communism, was a... For Britain, they sensed that this was their opportunity. This was their moment. That's how they could make their case. Not by talking about oil and profits and things like that, but by saying this is dangerous. Like, you can't, you know, Iran is getting destabilized. You need to do something.
And you had mentioned, today we would call it fake news, would be the 21st century term for it. But you had talked about the news coverage. And back then, of course, in the West, we had many fewer outlets. So it would have been almost the same message across multiple different media type platforms back then, broadcast networks, newspapers, radio. But when you had run down sort of the list of how it was being covered, well, you can see, I mean, the funny thing is we think about that as the good old days of journalism. I like to say that the good old days of journalism were between like 1968 and 1988. And this was before the era. This was post-yellow journalism, pre-modern journalism. But it was fake news is not a bad way to describe the way the Western public was receiving their information about this 1953 situation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's striking, right? Journalism was done very differently back then. It was a sort of gentleman's pursuit. There wasn't quite the same level of rigor and fact-checking and so on. And you look at the newspapers of the time, it's extraordinary the way they report this. You look at the New York Times in August of 1953, the day after the coup. And, you know, the report is, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact words of the headline, but it's something along the lines of, you know, a coup attempt is thwarted in Iran, that Mossadegh had tried to overthrow the Shah, and that, he had been thwarted, which is the literal opposite of what happened, right? I mean, it's this idea that the prime minister was trying to overthrow the king, and that, you know, that that this popular king had actually managed to you know, maintain himself in power, and, you know, the grateful public was cheered and relieved by this. I mean, it's the precise opposite of what actually happened. But over time, you know, the truth, I mean, in Iran, people, I think many people, you know, already kind of suspected the CIA hand, and over time it became more and more of an open secret until 20 years later in 1978 or 80, I think it was 81, Kermit Roosevelt, who was one of the kind of the real masterminds of the coup, published his memoir about it and was very open about his role and the sacks of cash that were being handed out in Tehran and the various dirty tricks that were being undertaken. And then finally in 2000, the New York Times published, the State Department released some documents, and they were published in the New York Times at length, in great length. CIA's own internal report on the coup. They still censored and redacted some of the language, but most of it was there. And this was literally a 70-page document, internal report written by the CIA describing in detail their, you know, how they did it. So there was no disputing it by that point.
So in 53, the democratically elected Mossadegh is overthrown. He's replaced by the absolute monarch who, you know, the feel you get for this guy, he's got an almost Kaiser Wilhelm kind of vibe, you know, fascinated by the military stuff, but not exactly. I mean, maybe go into a little depth, because this guy is going to be the one who determines the feel of this relationship for decades. Tell us a little bit about the last Shah of Iran.
He's an inscrutable figure. I mean, you know, like so many, you know, major leaders in world history. I mean, you know, no, who really knows the Shah? Who really knows who he was or what made him tick? You know, but there is an impression that we have of him. You know, he was many ways in his father's shadow. His father had been had come out of nowhere to overthrow the previous dynasty. You know, he had been a rough, crude, illiterate Cossack soldier in the 1920s. But the son, the younger Shah, you know, had been sent off to boarding school in Switzerland, to Le Rosé, one of the most elite private boarding schools in the world. Was a very cosmopolitan, refined, well-mannered young man, a very good-looking, you know, sort of a ladies' man, but not a tough guy like his father, you know. And you know, there's always a sense, and he writes about it in his own memoirs, that you could, that, you know, he talks about how his father's eyes could make him sort of shrivel up inside. I mean, he was terrified of his father. He said it was a relationship of awe and fear, but not always of love, you know. And yeah, I don't want to put someone on the couch, you know, who, you know, died, you know, when I was 7 years old. I mean, it's not, you know, I have no right to sort of psychoanalyze the Shah. But there is a sense that there was often a chip on his shoulder when it came to military affairs. From the very beginning, he was being quizzed and drilled by his father about, you know, kind of, you know, military questions. And, you know, his whole reign, he was obsessed with buying really big, fancy, expensive military hardware, you know, the latest fighter jets and the latest tanks and helicopters and everything, and much of it from the United States. By the 1970s, the Nixon administration, who loved the Shah, gave him a blank check to buy all the American military hardware he wanted. But before that, you know, there had been some resistance, especially from the Kennedy administration, you know, who told him, look, no, you need to, you know, invest in your country and you know, literacy and, you know, political reform and rights and things like that, healthcare and so on, land reform. And he did a lot of that, but it wasn't always done as well as it could have been done. And it was never accompanied by political reform or real political participation, genuine avenues for people to participate in the election, in parliamentary elections. Parliamentary elections were largely a joke in the 1950s and 60s and 70s anyway. But he really cared about the military. And he was a strong man. He was a tough guy. He was a sort of a right-wing leader. He was a believer in strength and militarism as a way to protect the country against communism or against any other kind of external threat.
Give us an idea of the amount, because you blew my mind with some of the, if you just asked a trivia question, who was the United States' biggest arms customer in certain years in the 1970s? I would never have said Iran, but weren't they one of the top U.S. customers for arms? You said that they saved several of the of some of our aerospace companies, I believe.
Absolutely. A lot of, I mean, you know, Grumman and Westinghouse, so many of these companies, Boeing, I mean, were struggling in the 1970s. It was economically a difficult time, lots of job layoffs and so on, unemployment. But yeah, I mean, Iran, I mean, so there was that angle as well. I mean, the Nixon administration was quite happy to help save some of these companies, you know, the gigantic Iranian contract. But it was more than that. It's part of the so-called Nixon doctrine. You know, Nixon had come to, you know, to power in the beginning years of the Vietnam War, when there was a real attempt to try to exit some of these quagmires in the Third World. And you know, he really liked the idea that you know, American foreign policy, it was important to find loyal, helpful regional powers that could protect and advance American interests in their respective regions, and could be rewarded with arms sales. And the Shah of Iran was probably the ultimate epitome of that. The sort of policeman of the Persian Gulf for the United States. You know, the famous, you know, moment when Nixon goes to Tehran with Henry Kissinger and, you know, leans across the table and says to him, you know, protect me. That's what I need here. You know, I'll give you all the weapons you want, but, you know, protect us here. because the U.S. is not in a position to be able to police the Persian Gulf, you know, in the 1970s. Now, it's not a one-way street. Of course, the Shah is always very, also very good at manipulating the U.S. And kind of getting what he wants out of the U.S. And he is, by the 1970s, a seasoned, experienced, smart leader who knows and understands global geopolitics very well. And the relationship between him and Richard Nixon is very good by the 1970s. They're big admirers of each other. But, of course, they both go down in some kind of ignominy.
Well, let's talk about that, because from a if we look at this just from a geostrategic standpoint, forget human rights, forget religion, forget all these other things, and let's just talk, you know, the old risk board game, right? The difference between having a friendly Iran in our camp, in what the Middle East and that whole region looks like, to not having a to having an adversarial Iran is so different that this is where you really see the damage from the blowback from 1953. I mean, if you play the what if game today and say, if you have a friendly Iran today, how different is the entire region? I would struggle to even begin to examine the ramifications of something like that. Can you give us an idea, though, about how important, at least in the, you know, without fantasizing about what it might be like today, how important was it in the mid-1970s for the United States and its allies?
Look, the Iranian Revolution, we forget now because it was kind of a long time ago, but the Iranian Revolution of 1979 was a devastating blow for American foreign policy. Absolutely devastating. No one saw it coming. And it was one of the cataclysmic failures of the Carter administration, or rather it was seen that way. I think Carter sometimes gets too much of the blame for the Iranian Revolution. And he was raked across the coal by his political enemies, by Kissinger, by the Republicans, who constantly harped on the idea that he was the man who lost Iran, quote unquote. Iran was a very, very important American ally in the 1970s. It was routinely described by American president, you know, LBJ described it, you know, he said what was happening in Iran was just about the best thing going, you know, and you know, routinely American officials and presidents would describe Iran as an island of stability in an otherwise troubled region, like it's just critical to American foreign policy. There was no other ally that bought that level of weaponry that advanced American interests so broadly in the region, and not just its own, you know, interests, but American interests in various parts of the Middle East. You know, Iran was and always is and continues to be a very important country in the region. There's a reason why we're so obsessed with, you know, kind of this hostility towards Iran these days, because look, it's a big country. It's a country of, you know, today 80 million people, at the time about 35 million people, but one of the largest in the region, both in terms of population and geography. And of course, one of the world's largest oil producers, and, you know, and occupies a key strategic position between the Soviet Union and the Persian Gulf and all these kinds of things. And we lost it. You know, I don't want to put it in these kinds of American foreign, purely kind of American foreign policy terms, but if you do, it's like we lost Iran. And that was a huge blow. But not just that, but it, you know, compounded by the fact, the way we lost Iran, which was that it was, you know, it was lost on the back of a religious revolution that rejected all of the basic premises of the Cold War. You know, the concern had been, at the time, that if there's a revolution in a third world country, it's going to be a communist revolution. No one saw a religious revolution coming. It was the first great religious revolution of the modern era. And, you know, it was just completely outside the playbook. And it inspired other types of movements like it in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in other parts of the Middle East. You know, it's something that and, you know, it helped to fuel a lot of the kind of and beyond, you know, because the big lesson that was drawn actually by so many people throughout the region was here you had a king who had the world's, I forget, fourth or fifth largest army, 400,000 men, one of the world's largest and most brutal secret police apparatus, the support of the United States, and to some extent the Soviet Union, all the world's great powers. He had everything. He'd been in power for 38 years. And yet it was all blown away, brushed away by a religious revolution led by an 80-year-old cleric. You know, how would you not draw the conclusion? If you're a devout, you know, Muslim, how would you not draw the conclusion that God was on their side in some way, and that there's something to be said for religion as a motivating force for radicalism and revolution. For all of those reasons, the Iranian Revolution is such a watershed and such a loss and such a blow to American foreign policy.
So let me go back. So one of the biggest, most interesting revelatory parts of the book for me were what you just described, because when we think about revolutions that are touting the plight of the poor or the people who have needs in society or the downtrodden or the ones who need education and all these kinds of things against, you know, the corrupt powers that be in the 1970s, especially, you think about that as a sort of a Marxist platform. That's the area where they're usually able to make some hay, as we say here in the States. But this is a different thing, because this is, as you point out in the book, this is not a radical left-wing sort of revolution. This is a conservative religious one, but that's pushing the same sort of thing, offering hope and help to the poor, to the downtrodden. Can you, I mean, you've introduced it a little bit, but can you talk a little about that? Because you can see how something like that in a region with so much poverty, especially outside the major cities, how something like this would not just be popular, but that that could be a base of support that keeps it in power for a long time. It's an interesting movement.
It is. I mean, it's a fascinating revolution, just for me as a historian. It's a fascinating revolution. You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, in many ways, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 adopts a lot of the language of the left and of the Marxists. So they talk about, you know, where, you know, people, when the, you know, Marxists talk about, you know, the you know, workers of the world uniting and so on. You know, it's a lot of that kind of language, but they don't put it as much in the language of kind of workers and trade unions and labor and so on, but they talk about the oppressed of the earth. And to this day, the Islamic Republic plays up a lot of that language. They have a foundation called the Bunyad al-Mustatsafin, you know, the foundation of the oppressed, which was funded by seized assets and money taken from the Shah's regime. You know, they really play up that kind of stuff, that anti-imperialist, sort of materialist rhetoric. But what's striking is that about the revolution is that, you know, again, you know, during, in 1979, the world is divided heavily between communism, the kind of the Soviet bloc, and the American bloc, the capitalist democratic bloc. And what really is extraordinary about the Iranian Revolution is that it's the first movement, the first revolution that says, you know, both of these political, you know, you have to say the Third World, as it was known, was constantly being asked to choose between these two blocs, right? And of course, there was a non-aligned movement and so on. But
yeah, Nehru and all those people, right?
Right. There was this feeling of, you know, you're with us, you're with the Soviets, or you're with, you know. And the Iranian revolutionary said, you know, both of these political philosophies are fundamentally materialist. You know, whether you're a communist or a capitalist, you're making your arguments to the people based on what is going to improve their material welfare, right? What's going to improve their bottom line. And no one's attending to people's spiritual welfare. That there is a different path. There is a sort of third way between, you know, Marxism and capitalism, which is God. You know, you had a lot of revolutionary leaders who would talk about, you know, Muhammad and, you know, as the first socialist and, you know, the sort of this kind of idyllic 7th century world and, you know, in 7th century Arabia around the Prophet and his family where everyone was equal and, you know, there was no poverty and wealth was shared and so on. Because, of course, Islam, as you know, many of your listeners will know, is a religion that does emphasize a lot the alleviation of poverty and giving to the poor and all those kinds of things. So it was easy for people who were very leftist in the 1970s to find ways to kind of fuse that kind of language with Islam and say, hey, you know what? Both, you know, communism and capitalism, these are foreign imports. They have no place here. Like, you know, let's draw on some of our own traditions. You know, instead of letting the Russians and the Americans fight, you know, squabble over us, why don't we, you know, tap into our own traditions? And that's a very intoxicating message, right? For, you know, in a closed society where, you know, people don't have a lot of avenues for political participation, to be able to turn to authentic traditions. You had this revolution, this revolution that was very radical in its way. But it's difficult to know how to place it on the sort of left-right spectrum because it kind of rejected that whole spectrum.
What if we compare it then to outcomes? So I think one could make a case that those other two systems of government that you mentioned, whether we're talking about communism as practiced in reality as opposed to a classroom version, or capitalism as practiced in reality as opposed to a classroom version, I would argue that neither one of those sides necessarily lived up to the marketing hype very well. How would you grade the Islamic Republic's revolution and how well they were able to manage to live up to the marketing?
No, I mean, also, like most revolutions, about the same. I mean, you know, there were some genuine changes, some genuine achievements. I mean, look, when you look over the last 40 years, you know, if you want to talk about what has the Iranian revolution achieved, I mean, it did achieve some. One of its biggest achievements was genuine foreign policy independence. Whatever criticisms people might have of the Islamic Republic today, no one will ever accuse it of being a lackey or a puppet of anyone, of the West, of the United States, the Soviet Union, or even of Russia. I know sometimes there's a bit of a rhetoric about Russia these days, but I mean, you know, Iran is not, you know, Russia is not a propping up the Islamic Republic. I mean, Russia is a fair weather friend to the Islamic Republic. So it's achieved that. It did achieve some genuine income and wealth redistribution. A lot of impoverished people were genuinely lifted out of poverty in the 1980s and 90s and so on. Now, on the other hand, of course, you can talk about the lack of social freedoms and the more repressive religious aspects of the Iranian revolution. Of course, it never promised freedom. It never claimed to be a liberal revolution in that sense. It was never meant as a revolution about people's individual freedoms. You know, Khomeini was very clear about that. It was about freeing Iran from the yoke of this dictatorial leader who had, you know, in the rhetoric of the revolution at the time, sold the country, you know, to foreigners.
Okay, so then you go from, I'm going to skip over because I think it's, when we talk about the American hostages, for example, or Reagan taking over in the free, to me, this stuff is not as important as something like the 1979-1980 Iraq War, for example, and something that Americans don't know anywhere near enough about. As a military history interested person growing up in that era, the Iran-Iraq War was the largest thing we'd seen in a long time. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, this was... Again, you're right. We forget about this now. It's not a war that is very deep in the consciousness of America.
Well, poison gas was used, everything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this was a generation-shaping, formative experience for Iranians of the 1980s. I mean, Iran had not, with the exception of, obviously, Iran had been invaded and got sucked into the Second World War, but with relatively few casualties. In the First World War, there had been a lot of casualties, but mostly from hunger and famine. You have to go back to the 1820s to find a war that Iran was deeply involved with, a lot of casualties. And even then, Iran had simply never experienced something like this, where you had hundreds of thousands of people dying, boys, soldiers, child soldiers being sent to the trenches, poison gas. It was a First World War-style war. That killed hundreds of thousands of people on both sides, both in Iraq and Iran. And it was the first time that chemical weapons had been used since the First World War. And it was devastating. And it is something that stays very much with Iranians to this day. You go to Iran, people are always in the U.S. very fixated on Iran's relationship with the United States and its antagonism to the U.S. But its war with Iraq in the 1980s shaped what Iran is today much more than its antagonism to the U.S. And it continues to do that in many, many ways. And you see it when you go to Iran, the murals. Yeah, there are a number of anti-American murals, anti-Israeli murals, and so on. But the vast majority of the murals painted on the walls are commemorating martyrs of the Iran-Iraq War. That's the really powerful experience. And I think it continues to motivate Iran's thinking to this day when it comes to issues like the nuclear program that I write about at length in the book. I argue that actually the degree to which Iran has sort of messed around with nuclear technology has largely been out of its fear of Saddam Hussein up until 2000.
Well, and I don't think you can understand as an American all of our involvement in the region in the 1990s with Saddam Hussein without understanding the 1980s. And I mean, Saddam Hussein was exactly the kind of guy that normal U.S. foreign policy would have been in opposition of in the 1980s, right? So we would have called it a Soviet client state. And yet because of the problems we had in the late 70s, early 80s with Iran, we'd rather back Saddam either openly or clandestinely rather than the Islamic Republic. It's a it's interesting how that turned out. So let me ask then the next thing, which is we look at relatively recent times with Iran and words like terrorism come up, Israel comes up, the protests within Iran amongst a lot of times Iranian youth and how those can get crushed. And so talk to me now a little bit about sort of, let's say, post-Iran-Iraq war aspects of Iran here. So in other words, I want to find out how Iran's doing from you in a second. But since the focus has shifted away from the Islamic Revolution and Khomeini and hostages and all that, Iran, I just wrote down terrorism, Israel, because I mean, when you look at it now, the unrest in the street. I mean, who was it? It was the female martyr not that long ago who was shot. I mean, it would seem to be that once again, now the Islamic Republic's in the position that the Shah was in the late 1970s. But that may be a reaction to Western news coverage that doesn't really reflect attitudes on the ground. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about Israel terrorism, internal unrest in Iran. And maybe, you know, we talked recently a lot about where in my other programs, where things are going in the 21st century as opposed to the 20th. How could we apply that to Iran? How do you see the sort of the next couple of decades maybe?
Yeah, I mean, those are all great questions.
And that's a lot. It's a lot of stuff. I apologize. Yeah.
Sure. No. It's fine. I mean, look,
I think of them as interrelated, if that makes sense.
Right. No, absolutely. Look, as a historian, I'm always a little uncomfortable with kind of making predictions and thinking about the future, because I tend to think much more about the past. But, I think if we look at Iran today, look, there's no question the Islamic Republic is less popular than it has been at any point in its history. And there are many different reasons for that. I mean, of course, it's come under exceptional degrees of kind of American-led pressure, maximum pressure campaigns, sanctions. I mean, the kinds of sanctions that have never been placed on a country in peacetime. I mean, Iranian economy has been strangled.
Right. It's an axis of evil country, right?
Right. But of course, that's not the only reason. I mean, there are many reasons why people dislike the system and the government, you know, on its own terms. And there are plenty of issues with corruption and mismanagement, and of course repressiveness. It's a really tough time in Iran today. It's a tough time to be Iranian and to live in Iran. The economy is in desperate straits in many ways. Inflation is very bad. People are really struggling. And yet we have to be careful. There is a fantasy narrative in the U.S., which is that, you know, that the regime, when is this going to all collapse? When is it all going to come crumbling down? You know? And it's not. I mean, it's just the Islamic Republic is not a house of cards. I mean, is it wildly popular among the Iranian people? No, not necessarily. I mean, you know, the Iranian public, like publics everywhere, you know, you has a wide range of opinions on a lot of things, you know, and you go to Iran and you'll hear all kinds of different things. People are angry with the government for all kinds of different things. You're not going to hear a huge appetite for revolution and regime change, and certainly not kind of foreign-backed regime change. Iranians are smart enough to realize that, you know, the U.S. isn't pressuring the Iranian government or trying to bring about regime change because the American government's, you know, kind of heart is bleeding for the Iranian people, or, you know, trying to improve, you know, concerned about their human rights. They know that. They know that, you know, this is about geopolitics and the fact that Iranian and American political interests are very much, you know, do not align. So they are going to be skeptical of any kind of American-backed attempts to kind of, you know, foment regime change, because they've seen how that's gone in Syria, in Libya, in other places in the region. Nor is there an obvious opposition leader that has any real kind of large-scale credibility. And then, you know, as unpopular as it may be to say, the Islamic Republic does have its supporters, and they're not small in number. People who have grown up with this system of government and who have been rewarded well from it and have jobs and careers and, you know, people who've been lifted out of poverty. Now, as I say, all of that is true. It's also true that it's, you know, at its, the lowest point of its popularity by far, I think, of any point in the last 40 years. But that doesn't mean that it's, you know, any minute now it's all going to come crashing down. This is a fantasy that's constantly been peddled since the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution. You know, this idea that, you know, the Islamic Republic won't last. But it has lasted. And without a lot of friends or allies around the world, and under a lot of pressure in the U.S. I just think that, you know, people who are focused on bringing down the system, you know, have to exist. You have to accept the world as it is, not as you want it to be. You know, I'm no fan of the Islamic Republic, but that does, you know, I'm not going to sit here and you know, try to cheerlead regime change because that doesn't seem like a very realistic kind of scenario.
You know, I'm curious about the intrusion of the outside world into some of these systems. I was talking to somebody the other day about whether or not the old Soviet Union could have existed in a world with the kind of communication we have now, because, I mean, they used to freak out over one radio signal from Radio Free Europe. What would they do, you know, with Facebook or something like that? How is Iran adjusting? Because I know the Iranians tend to be, on an individual level, very tech interested. How are they coping with the fact that, you know, the outside world, you had mentioned something in your book that stuck with me. You had been talking about, you mentioned disco. So it was like the 1970s, and this was something that the Ayatollahs were not thrilled about, as one might imagine no conservative society would have been. And I'm thinking to myself, forget about disco today. I mean, what do the Iranian Ayatollahs think about pornography online that their people might be looking at? I mean, how much does the fact that the outside world can't really be kept out anymore impact a revolution that's trying to maintain a certain, let's just say, moral a standard for their people?
It's a great question. It's a tough question.
Are they developing one of their own? I mean, are they one of those countries that are developing sort of an internal, you know, internet of their own kind of? I vaguely remember something like that.
Yeah, they were doing. I think. Again, I'm not a tech expert.
Me either.
I wonder how well that's ever going to work. But morality side of things, morality police, like things like the Ministry of Islamic Education and Guidance, and these kinds of Orwellian things sound very Orwellian to us. They exist. They're reality. There are things. You know, there are, you know, morality police that go around and, you know, Gashtarishad, as they're called, and kind of check on people, the way people are dressed and, you know, things like that. And, you know, there are things you're not allowed to do in Iran. You can't just, like, be out there dancing in the streets and so on, wearing discos and, you know, alcohol and whatever. But the reality is that all of that stuff goes on very much behind closed doors in Iran. And the government is well aware of that and, frankly, doesn't really care that much. And now, that's not to say that a lot of these, you know, religious clerics who run the show like it, but they're not motivated by that in the way that the revolutionaries were in the 1970s. What they're motivated by is realpolitik and staying in power and survival and strengthening the system, and, you know, avoiding these kind of these foreign-backed regime change plots and so on, and you know, staying in power and doing what they're doing just enough to make sure people feel like they can live the life that they want to live and participate just a little bit in politics, while also preserving, you know, control and their own kind of survival as a system. The fact is that, you know, they know that people are out there having, you know, alcohol-fueled parties and dances in North Tehran and so on. You know, they're not going to barge into people's houses. You know, they feel like, you know, as long as people feel like they can do that kind of stuff, they're, you know, they're less likely to cause problems. They're not really worried about these, you know, these kinds of very westernized, you know, elites in North Tehran, because, you know, what they're more worried about right now is the fact that these sanctions have made life very difficult for their traditional support base, which is the poor, both rural and urban poor, who are really suffering a lot under these sanctions, much more than the wealthy and the westernized elites. That's more scary to them.
You know, I can't help but think that we would give our right arm now in the West to have a viable Mohammad Mossadegh that we could support as an alternative to the current leadership. Is something like that ever possible the way that the system's been constructed there in terms of outsiders or non-religiously approved candidates getting a chance to participate? Is there a chance to have a Mohammad Mossadegh, somebody who we would call, you would call it a liberal, democratic, moderate reformer type, or is that something that's been sort of sealed off by the design of the system?
I don't think that's in the cards now. I think that the closest we came to that was in the period between 1997 and 2005, during the reformist presidency of Mohammad Khatami, who was seen in many ways as a liberal, reform-minded, constitutionalist kind of president, who operated within, he was a cleric himself, who operated within the religious system. And there was a lot of excitement about that and what that might hold, what kind of promise that might hold for the future of Iran. But it didn't work out, both for internal and external reasons. I think in recent years, but there have been more attempts. There have been, the last president was more kind of centrist and, reform-minded in some ways. And there have been, the movement wasn't snuffed out completely after 2005. But I have to say recently, since the withdrawal of the U.S. from the JCPOA, from the nuclear deal in 2018, and the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration, that has had a pretty powerful impact. It has really helped to entrench hardline elements in Iran in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time, because that just made it very easy for hardline elements to say, you can't trust the United States and you can't trust these guys, because it was a more centrist, reformist government that negotiated that deal. And they were embarrassed. They were humiliated by the withdrawal of the United States. They brought sanctions relief, and there's this feeling that there's a whole new era now, and everything's going to be different. And you see, you can do a deal with the U.S. But it only lasted 3 years. And when the Trump administration withdrew, it just handed a huge political victory to conservative hardline elements. They said, look, forget about it. These guys were duped. They were the fools of the West and of the United States.
One of the disadvantages dealing with democratic systems is that one president could have a different attitude from the previous one. So let me ask you, was there anything that I didn't ask you about in this conversation that I should have, or that we can or that's relevant here that we should be talking about?
Well, I mean, I could talk for hours, but I mean, I think you hit on some great highlights and those are some great questions. So I really enjoyed the conversation.
I've done what you're doing, and you get so tired of the same questions. So if I could have asked you a few different things, we'll call it a minor victory, and hopefully we didn't bore you. This was wonderful. The subject matter is fascinating, and I hope we sell you a few books. So we will send you a link when the show is out, and anything. I mean, listen, man, if I can do any favors for you in the future or help you out in any way, please let me know.
I really appreciate that. You're helping me out quite a bit by helping to spread the word about the book. I really appreciate that. That means a lot. And I appreciate your questions, because, I mean, honestly, it's obvious that you've read the book, and you have some great, you kind of really engaged with it and asked some great questions. So I really appreciate it.
I love the topic. Thank you so much for coming on and taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
My thanks to John Gosvinian for coming on the program. His new book, America and Iran, A History 1720 to the Present, is presently available. Pick up your copy and find out all the answers to all the questions that in a nearly hour and 20-minute interview I didn't manage to get to somehow. Anyway, he was a wonderful guy to talk to, and the subject is fascinating. For those who wonder where the next Hardcore History show is, the big one, we are working on it, and like the famous multiple stages of grief, there is the multiple stages of Hardcore History show production. We are currently at the stage where we have hours of it in the can, and you look at it and go, now, what the heck do we have here? Is any of this any good? And so we'll, get through the subsequent stages and get it to you as soon as possible. What I always tell people is all of the carrots and sticks in this business are lined up towards releasing more content. So we have every incentive. We just fail miserably. Thanks for your patience, everybody. Looking forward to talking with you more soon. Stay safe.
For Hardcore History t-shirts or other merchandise, go to dancarlin.com.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.
Hey, everyone. Back for one quick second to talk again about Battle Guide virtual tours. You may have heard me bring them up before. I hooked up with these guys during the first bit of COVID when they were doing live tours of places like battlefields in France and everything, and all of a sudden were shut down. And this is the way they figured out how to pivot from that, as so many other business owners have had to figure out what to do in the same circumstances. And I love the way these guys did it. They converted the battlefield tours into virtual things, and it allowed them to utilize a bunch of different elements that obviously wouldn't have been available in a live situation. And I'm not saying this is superior to a live situation. They both have their strengths and weaknesses. What I am saying is, if you save up all the money as an American to go to northern France and walk these battlefields, first of all, there will be things missing that you won't understand and you'll have to come home and read about later, which you get as part of these Battle Guide virtual tours when you do those. But how likely are you next week, after you get home from what would be an expensive and long trip to France to do this, to want to go to Russia and visit Stalingrad, right? But you do that in the virtual sense. You can go on a different, you know, battlefield tour every day. There's different ways to access them, by the way. There's a live version, which you can be a part of it online when they're doing it live, and the historian is there, and you can ask questions and all kinds of things like that. So that's a real-time thing. But then that goes, you know, into the archives and is available for you to download anytime, anywhere, right, as a sort of a hard copy version. And you can buy those individually, or you can sign up for a subscription service and access all of them, and they have new ones all the time. I just think if you're a military history fan, this is a gimme kind of thing, and especially for a gift for people that you may know who are also military history fans. This is a fun thing, and it's worth trying. And if you'd like to just try it and get 50% off, you can go to battleguide.co.uk/Dan-Carlin. That's battleguide.co.uk/Dan-Carlin, and you'll get 50% off any one of the currently up on the archive tours. See what it's all about. But we're talking about something that combines, you know, technology like drone images, 360 and satellite imagery, on-the-ground video, veteran accounts, period footage, photographs. It's an interesting mix of things that, if you are interested in this kind of stuff, manages to illuminate the complexity of these battlefields in ways that is difficult to conceptualize in any other situation. Those of you out there who've read books, who've looked at maps, who've seen movies, you try to get a mental image of things. This is one of the best ways I've ever discovered to do it. I hope you'll check it out. Go to battleguide.co.uk/Dan-Carlin. Get 50% off and see what I'm talking about.